Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Well, it's good to be with you folks this afternoon. Let me get right into this. We're a little bit late getting started here. I'm going to go ahead and lecture on the topic of near-death experiences, and then I will invite questions and answers until we have to pull out of here a little after one. What is a near-death experience? I mean, that could be an issue when you just talk about definitions. Some of you might think that near-death experience happens every December and every June during final exam week or something. But it was actually a word that was coined about 25 years ago. And near-death is actually a state that is recognized in medical studies. And let me define it this way. Let me define states of death relative to definitions of dying. A near-death state is a state from which you can be expected to die if you do not have some immediate intervention, some immediate medical intervention. A near-death state, for example, might be, let's say somebody dials 911, paramedics come, and they find that you have no heartbeat, or very low or no measurable blood pressure, or you don't seem to be breathing, or your pulse, something like that. It's a state from which, as I said, you could be expected to die without some kind of medical intervention. Now, beyond that, of course, you start talking about death states. And there's no uniform definition in the West of death. Some people use a near-death definition if it's perpetuated over amount of time. Sometimes a heart death definition is used, where you have no heart activity for a significant amount of time. Arguably the most recognized definition of death, but it's seldom employed, actually, is no brain activity, absence of brain activity, the flat EEG. And I say it's not usually employed because seldom is an EEG hooked up, just like seldom is an EKG hooked up for the heart. And beyond these states, near death, let's say an increasing definition would be heart death, a stricter definition would be brain death, and last of all, a fourth level we could call biological death. And here's a definition of biological death. By definition, after that point, there's no report of any data. And if there's any experience, it's not biological death. In other words, biological death is defined as a state from which there can be no physical return, no physical recovery. Because if you take the previous definition, the so-called Harvard definition, the flat brain wave definition, there are some select cases. In fact, I could say at each of these levels, there are many cases of people who have reported data beyond each of these stages, beyond the near-death stage, beyond the flat heart rate, beyond even the flat brain wave. And even that last one, there's an interesting category of data. Now, what I thought I'd do with you today is just tell you a bunch of stories. Many of these have been written up, often in medical journals. So they've passed peer review, they're written by scholars, often by the people in attendance. You got a sheet, most of you when you came in, or there's some back there, I guess, for those of you who don't have the sheet. And I'm not going to follow the sheet exactly, but you've got some cases there, and on the back you have some documentation of some of these. But let me start with some cases that purport to report a near-death phenomena in a near-death state, and then I'll move up the line to flat heart, flat brain, and keep going, and just see what we come up with. Okay. The first case on your list is a well-known case. In fact, some have said it's the most publicized near-death state in the literature. It was reported in a Seattle hospital, and a young woman, Maria, had just come to town to visit some relatives. She'd not been in Seattle before, and she had a heart attack. And it was a pretty severe heart attack, and she was taken to the hospital, and she was basically comatose, and they revived her at the hospital. And later, she started saying some interesting things. She said, I watched the guys bring me in on the cart. They said, well, how could you watch people bring you in? You're on the cart. And she said, no, I was kind of up above it, and I was watching, kind of hovering there and watching people work on me. And I can tell you this, one guy came in, and he looked like this, and his clothes looked like this, and he was doing this, and they were doing this, and they were doing that. And then she said, I started kind of drifting back, and she said, I started getting above the hospital a little bit. And she said, you know, funny thing, on the far wing of the hospital, on the roof of the hospital over there, she said, there's a tennis shoe. And she said, when I looked at it, I just kind of zeroed in on it. I kind of got the zoom lens kind of effect. And she said, it's a really large men's tennis shoe, and it's the old blue canvas kind of shoe. So the little toe is worn almost all the way through, and the laces are tied underneath the shoe. That's on top of your roof. Well, one of the persons who came in was a social worker, and she's cited on the back in the sources. Her name is Kim, and Kim spent the next day or so during her breaks looking over on that part of the hospital and going into the rooms and kind of looking out the windows and see if she could see anything, and she couldn't find anything. And finally, this last part of the hospital that she had checked, she kind of looked around the corner of the window, and up around this corner was this tennis shoe. And she kind of extended herself a little bit around the corner and kind of out the window. It wasn't really dangerous, but she had to stretch a little bit. And she grabbed this shoe, and the laces were not tied underneath it, but the tennis shoe was sitting on top of the laces. And it was a blue tennis shoe, and it was canvas, and the little toe was threadbare, and it was a size 14. And she brought it downstairs, and she went into Maria's room, and she came in with her hands behind her back, and she said, Maria, tell me one more time what that shoe looked like. And Maria told her, and she said, is this it? And she pulled the shoe out. Well, that's a very well-documented case, and of course, responses to that would be that Maria was not dead. She was in a near-death state. Near-death is a state from which literally millions of people have recovered. Now, why do I say millions? In a Gallup survey, I believe 1982, 8 million Americans claimed to have experienced near-death phenomena of one sort or another. Now, of course, people can say things and be mistaken or not have them, but 8 million people claim to have experienced near-death phenomena. Now, that's an example. And today, I'm not interested in how many people report tunnels or lights or, you know, seeing loved ones or reporting angels or spirit beings. I'm not going to do I'm not playing a numbers game today, as if to say, all right, 8 million Americans have experienced this, therefore it must be true. Okay, we're not going to do any kind of argument like that, because that's not a very good argument. In fact, in some medical studies, you can stimulate the right temporal lobe over your right ear, and you can have near-death simulation. You can experience phenomena often associated with near-death experiences. The tunnel, the light, seeing people, hearing voices, etc., feeling peaceful. So that might just be common biology. I'm not so interested today in in what might be common biology, but I'm interested in veridical cases. I'm interested in cases where there are data which suggest that something is going on during a state of temporary cessation of consciousness. And obviously, in order to get that, we've got to go up a little bit from near-death cases, because if this survey is anywhere near correct, many, many, many people have been brought back from these states or claim to have had phenomena while somewhere in the vicinity of being near death. And how do we know? They could be lying. This could be common biology. They could have had an experience which is not grounded in anything. So what are some of these evidential cases? And the rest of the ones I'll present to you today are going to be moving up this ladder. We'll even have a little bit of near-death humor before this is over, some humorous near-death cases. Now, I've been collecting these for 30 years, just hit my 30th anniversary collecting these, and I have almost 100 cases which are evidential in nature. Some of them are mildly evidential. The Tennessee case is mildly evidential, but some of them are much more interesting. Before I go up to the flat heart level, let me tell you about an interesting study that came out a few years ago. You've got one case on there. I think it may be your third case, but a case with a blind patient. A study was done a number of years ago, published in a peer-reviewed journal by a psychologist and a nurse, and they did studies with several dozen patients who were blind, who had been blind from birth. Not somebody who lost their sight, you know, at age 30 or something like that, but they were blind from birth, or, you know, from the time they were in the hospital, and they would ask these persons, what did you experience? And they would often say, well, they'd have a pretty typical near-death experience. They would say, I had this experience of moving down this tunnel and seeing this light and being at peace and seeing these people. But they have not claimed to have seen anything before or after that time. And, of course, after this experience, they were still sightless. So it's not like they were, you know, from that time on they could see or something. It was only for that very short period of time. And some of them reported evidential cases. You have one in there of a woman who claimed to have been with two friends in a near-death state. She had never seen those friends before, but because she had been blind from birth congenitally, and she gave physical descriptions of these two ladies. But it's interesting because some of them saw things like certain doctors coming down the hallway outside of the room. Near-death patients are often attracted to loved ones. They're often attracted to people they know. And they would say, well, I saw Dr. So-and-so, and what's Dr. So-and-so look like? You've never seen him. Well, he's this tall, and he looks like this, and here's what he had on that day. And they could report what was going on in the near-death state. Now, it's still near-death. So we have to go a little higher in that to get some more evidence. Maybe I'll stop here and give you a quick case of near-death humor. As I said, people are often attracted to loved ones. And in one particular case, this woman was having surgery, and her relatives were down the hall and waiting in the waiting room, the operational waiting room. And she reached a point in the operation that was pretty serious. And she was in this near-death state, and she said she was first kind of above her body, and then she was kind of out of the room, and she kind of was able to look in on where her relatives were walking around. And she saw her brother-in-law, standing up, and he was pacing across this room. And he said, if she's going to kick the bucket, I hope she hurry up and does it, because I've got an appointment in a little while. And when she came to, she repeated the words to him and thanked him for his confidence and his love. You always want to be careful what you say around dying people. Okay. Well, okay. But by the way, that's an interesting comment around dying people. And all these definitions of death, nobody thinks of death as something that happens in 5 seconds. You know, like the old Westerns on television, you know, where the guy says, They hid the gold in the... Okay, you don't die like that. And death is a process with a cessation, a progressive cessation of senses. And one of the last senses to go, they think, is hearing. And so presumably people could hear things in the room for perhaps 5 minutes. In fact, that gets us to our next definition. A lot of people have come back from heart attacks. I know of a man. In fact, I was lecturing in Tennessee 2 weeks ago, and I met this guy's relatives. I've been giving this case for years, and here I met his relatives. There are a lot of people who've come back from near-death states, sometimes many times. This man was in a cardiologist's office in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They put him up on the treadmill, to have a stress test, and he had a heart attack right in the doctor's office. That's a pretty convenient place to have a heart attack, because the doctor who was tending to him was one of the first CPR experts in the world. The guy was an agnostic. The medical doctor was an agnostic. And this patient passed out from a heart attack, and the doctor's reviving him. And when he came to, he said his hair was standing straight up, and he said, "Doctor, doctor, I'm in hell. Save me." Well, the doctor's still working on him, and the guy has another heart attack. He had 7 consecutive heart attacks, and the medical doctor brought him back. And one time he said to the doctor, "I'm in hell. I'm in hell. What should I do?" And the medical doctor, like I said, he's an agnostic. And the guy said, "I don't know. I'm not a pastor. Pray. Do something." And he's working on the guy. Well, the guy came to, and they got him in the hospital. And a couple days later, the doctor's got his pen. He's got his clipboard. He goes in to talk to the patient. He said, "Hey, I'm curious about something. Tell me about this hell thing." And this guy said, "Hell?" He said, "Yeah, tell me about hell." And the guy said, "I don't know anything about hell." And he said, "Well, every time we brought you to the other day, you kept saying you were in hell. I mean, there were nurses standing around and everything else, and I'm not a religious man, but I wonder what you meant." And the guy said, "I'm not saying you're lying. I'm just saying I don't have any recollection of that whatsoever." So my point there is that we have a lot of people in this country who've been near death. And some of them, like this man, reports consecutive states. Now, there's another doctor, Michael Sabom, a cardiologist in Atlanta, who's been cataloging these things for 30 years. He also has cases where people have had consecutive heart attacks, and once or twice they will have memories, and the rest of the time they don't. They blacked out. As far as they're concerned, they have no memories. So there's a lot of different interspersed kind of experiences here. All right, now, beyond what point is evidential for the next level, for a flat heart? Doctors disagree, but it seems that after five minutes, it's pretty substantial that if you were to come back after 5 minutes, first of all, it's extremely rare. Some doctors would even tell you it's impossible to have heart stoppage for 5 minutes. And to report things. One medical doctor says 7 minutes. He's the only one I know that goes that high. He says 7 minutes, and it's over. So, I mean, I've got one where there's heart stoppage for 19 minutes. One where there's heart stoppage where actually some nurses went and got this cardiologist and said, "Hey, you got to come in here." And they took him into the girls' bathroom, and a nurse had hung herself off from the door. She'd hung herself from the door, and they got her down and started resuscitating her. She had no heartbeat, and that was for a significant period of time. But the best I've ever seen, the longest time, is a person who came back from 40 minutes without heart activity. 40 minutes. And they gave a description, kind of a blow-by-blow, step-by-step description of what happened through when the EMTs came and they were taken to the hospital and what happened in the emergency room. They could tell what happened, and they claimed to be kind of up above the activity watching. And I should tell you this, when you talk to people who have had near-death experiences, even with a group this size, there's probably a number of people in here who've either had one or somebody in their family has, because they're fairly common. But oftentimes the person, it's funny, they'll see the person down there, and they act like it's funny. They'll see the person down at the table, and they'll say, look at that poor guy. Looks like he's in distress. Everyone's beating on him. I wonder what's going on. They say, that guy looks like me a little bit. But they don't think of it as being them because they perceive their center of consciousness to be up here. You know, you don't usually stop and look at your hands and say, yeah, that's me. That's what I put on this morning. You know, you just kind of look out at the world, so to speak. And so they often don't recognize what's going on down there. I should also tell you that when the doctor's resuscitating them, or an EMT or something like that, and they come back into their body, frequently they are very angry. You know, I was having a great time, I was feeling well, what'd you have to go and do this for? You know, I'm not feeling well. Some of them, I mean, you know, you can CPR, and with some techniques, you can get a broken rib, or, you know, you could be in a significant amount of pain. Sometimes these people are in pain because of the situation they were in before the near-death experience. All they know is that up here, they were peaceful, and they didn't know who that was, poor guy, and then all of a sudden, they're him. And, you know, they're watching through their own eyes. To me, the most evidential of the categories is the brain death category. And there's some cases here that I think are highly evidential. There is a cardiologist in Denver, Colorado. He has a pacemaker named after him. He's a well-known scientist. And he has the largest number of near-death cases. He has, this is a figure that's old right now, but at the time of the publication, which was early 80s, he had 2,300 near-death patients who were near death, 2,300 near-death patients. And of those 2,300 patients, 1,600 of them claimed to have had some kind of near-death experience, 16 out of 2,300. And I'll just stop and tell you that in most cases, the percentage of people who are near death who claim to have had some kind of experience are between one-third and two-thirds. Between one-third and two-thirds of the cases. And his sample, you can do some quick math, is pretty much exactly two-thirds. But of those 1,600 people who said they had near-death experiences, 57 of them reported near-death phenomena while they were in a state of mind where they had no brainwave activity. No brainwave activity, and many of them reported data that could be observable during the state in which they had no brainwave activity. In fact, many of these 57 people had no brainwave activity for up to 2.5 to 3 hours. You say 5 minutes is evidential. These people had no brainwave activity, a number of them, 2.5 to 3 hours. And the doctor said that many of them reported phenomena that he could check out, things that were verifiable in and about the room. In fact, his assistant, who is a pastor now, but his assistant at the time has cataloged some of this data. The doctor doesn't slow down long enough to do it. He does a lot of open heart surgeries and you know, working many, many hours a week. And he doesn't catalog himself, but assistant has. Now, here's a near-death case, a flat brainwave case from another doctor. This is an Indiana housewife, and she was being operated on, and they had her hooked up with EEG, and that's kind of rare to hook somebody up, but she was hooked up, and she had no brainwave activity for 2 to 3 hours. Now, she's not one of the other doctor's patients, but this is a separate case. No brainwave activity for 2 to 3 hours. While on the table, they pronounced her dead. They tried resuscitation techniques, and they were not successful. After 45 minutes of working on her, they pronounced her dead. They covered her with a sheet, and the hospital attendants came in to take her to the hospital morgue. And while they were pushing her down the hall, she sat up. We call this NDE Twilight Zone. She sat up, and they went and got doctors. They injected her with some adrenaline, and she did pass away after that. She had a pretty advanced case of cancer. But she lived through that episode after she was brought to after 3 hours of no brainwave activity. Now, it's not evidential that a person is brought back. It's very rare to be brought back when there's no brainwave activity. That's pretty rare. But that's not evidential unless you have people report activity that can be verified during the state in which their brains were not active. And she talked about the whole process, what happened while they're resuscitating her. Her brain, she had no brainwave activity measured on the machine. And she reported who came in the room, who went out of the room. She mentioned a doctor's name who cracked a joke to relieve tension in the room. She told about jewelry that some of the attendants were wearing. And she said so-and-so had this kind and so-and-so had that kind. And she reported this as soon as she was resuscitated. I mean, the reports came immediately. It didn't take... You want to be careful because these stories can get bigger with time, of course. So you want to get reports that are where the data are given immediately. And she gave some of this data right away. Now, my favorite... my favorite case I'll save till later. But my favorite flat brainwave case is, I think, the second case on your sheet there. And it's a little girl from Idaho who was called at the time Katie. This has been written up in at least two different journal articles, at least two different medical journal articles, Journal of Pediatrics and a second journal. She was taken to a hospital room after she was underwater for 19 minutes. Now you can, it doesn't take a lot of thinking to realize that her heart or brain wasn't working after being underwater for 19 minutes. But when they got her to the emergency room, they continued to check her vital signs later, got her out of the water, rushed her to the hospital room, to the emergency room, and worked on her. Now, the pediatrician who worked on her, he's cited on the back. His name is Melvin Morse. He was an agnostic. And, it's not enough today to be a pediatrician. Right? You have to have a subspecialty and a subspecialty. This guy was a brain specialist pediatric doctor, and he was doing the work in the emergency room that night. So here's this pediatrician who has all this research on brain states, and here Katie is brought in, being underwater for 19 minutes. Her eyes were profoundly comatose. She was profoundly comatose. There's no eye movement and no brainwave activity. They worked on her in the emergency room and couldn't do anything else for her and hooked her up to machines in ICU. And 3 days later, she spontaneously came to. Now, I say spontaneously because they didn't do anything else to her except keep her alive. They weren't doing any incredible efforts to bring her back. She was in ICU hooked up. And she came to. And Melvin Morris came in. I've had several conversations with him. We've talked for a few hours. And he said, imagine my interest when she looked up, when she first came to, and she looked up and she said, oh, you're that kind doctor who resuscitated me. Thank you. And she said, where's the tall, thin doctor without a beard? And he said, he's right down the hall here. I'll get him for you. And now she had been profoundly comatose, is his phrase, no brainwave activity this whole entire time while the two men were working on her. He went and got this medical doctor. They came in the room and sat there. I think he said it took them 1 hour to hear her story about what happened to her the last 3 days. And they're feverishly scribbling notes. And here's what she said. She said, first of all, I watched you when I was in the emergency room, and I was up above, and I could see what you were doing, and I could see different things in the room. Okay, well, what's the emergency room look like? Well, this is over here, and this is over here, and this is over here, and this is red, and this is silver, and this is this, and you guys did this to me, and then this, someone did this to me. And she's describing this process, and totally, awed these guys. And then she said, an angel named Elizabeth came and got me, and I went off with Elizabeth. Okay, there's no test for angel's name Elizabeth. But she said that Elizabeth allowed her to look into her home that night and see what her parents and siblings were doing. No brainwave activity, profoundly comatose, and she said, I watched my parents. My dad came in the house, and he sat down over here, and he was staring straight ahead, just staring. She said, brother and a sister, they were upstairs. She told what the brother was playing with. She told what the sister was playing with. She told about a popular song that came on the radio that her brother was humming, and she named the song. And she said, my mom was in the kitchen cooking dinner. And Dr. Morris, you know, he's getting his pen out, taking notes. There's a contact point with the world. What did your mom make for dinner? And she said, roast chicken and rice. Roast chicken and rice. And when the family came in, he said to the mom, what did you make two nights ago for dinner? The night all this is, you know, happening. And to the father, what were you doing inside the house? And to the kid, what did you go up and play with? And do you remember the song that came on the radio? And to the daughter. And she was right down to the exact detail. Now, again, there's no test for Elizabeth, the angel, but she's reporting things that are going on in the world while she's strapped down on a table, hooked up to machines, profoundly comatose, without brainwave activity. So they start asking, you know, where do we go with these things, and what does this mean? Here's another case of near-death humor for you. One person was declared dead. They were on a table and pulled a sheet over top of them, and they're waiting for the hospital morgue, the fellows to come in and take the person to the morgue. And the scrub nurse came in and was scrubbing the room down while she was waiting for the body to be taken away. The person said they were not there. They were up above the, looking down on the woman working and on the whoever, whatever was under the sheet. And a doctor came in and started doing things with the nurse that doctors and nurses shouldn't be doing. And she reported what that was. Again, don't say things and don't do things around people who are, be really careful. Now, one case that got a lot of publicity was a very well-known British philosopher, Dr. Flew's here this afternoon. This is an acquaintance of his, a fellow by the name of A.J. Ayer, a longtime professor of philosophy at Oxford University. And if you've studied 20th century philosophy, especially from 1935 to the present, I think, and you study British philosophy in particular, you know these two fellows. You know Dr. Flew, and you know A.J. Ayer. A.J. Ayer wrote a book in 1936 called Language, Truth, and Logic, which was during the heyday of British positivism. He claimed in this book that only those propositions which could be empirically tested could be admissible, and you either know something by definition or you know something because it fits this verification hypothesis, this verification principle. Well, toward the end of his life, A.J. Ayer had a near-death experience. In fact, he had more than one. And I've never met Dr. Ayer. As I said, you can ask Dr. Flew. He knew him. But Dr. Ayer had a near-death experience and wrote a very intriguing article called What I Saw When I Died. Now, I don't know what an atheistic philosopher is going to say about what I saw when I died. I guess he would think he would see nothing. But he had a near-death experience, and he even says in the article that it was somewhat veridical. There were some tests, things while he was in that state that he could check out. Now, he says in the article, he says, being an atheist, he said, I stood before this light. I stood before this red light, he said, and I took this red light. He wouldn't call it God, but he said, I stood before this red light, and he said, I was given to believe that this being was responsible for the creation of the world. And now that, in my book, that would warrant the definition God, but he didn't say that. And he said, I stood before this being who was, you know, responsible for the universe.